In Bangladesh, a verdict for the former prime minister.
This is a measure of justice which they have been waiting for a year.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, the latest from Bangladesh on a historic day. Plus, a new player is taking a leading role on the way to reducing emissions.
China wants to step up, and China wants to be able to say that it is reducing the negative effects of climate change.
A report from China where there's a green revolution.
In the U.S., international student enrollment has taken a dip.
The fallout will hit hardest at schools that rely on international students to offset declining domestic enrollment.
And new insight into the human psyche.
We like to travel for a certain amount, but not too much.
That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for joining us. We begin today with climate news heading into week two of COP30, the United Nations Summit on Climate Change in Belém, Brazil. Benchmarks for reducing greenhouse gas emissions play a big part in these talks.
One country where carbon emissions have been flat or trending downward for a year and a half now is China. The country, once synonymous with over-reliance on fossil fuels and cities famously shrouded in smog. Now China is positioning itself as a world leader on renewables.
The World's Jeremy Siegel gets us going with his reporting from Shenzhen, China, where he learned that reducing emissions is not the country's only reason for going green.
I am outside of the convention center in downtown Shenzhen, and I've never seen anything like this. It's like a huge parking lot combined with a gas station, the biggest gas station you've ever seen in your life. But instead of gas, it's all chargers and electric cars everywhere, all of them plugged in, getting the juice that they need to go about the rest of their day.
What I'm looking at here in Shenzhen is nothing out of the ordinary. At least here it's not. There are too many chargers to count. It's a far cry from what you'd have seen 20 years ago, when green infrastructure was virtually non-existent in China, and the country's major cities were famous for their thick smog. At the time, China was laser-focused on growing its economy, no matter the environmental cost.
But now, since people get richer, right, they care more about their health.
That's Jinfen Zhang, a professor of finance at the Chinese University of Hong Kong in Shenzhen. He tells me as the country's economy has grown and the average household's disposable income more than doubled over the past two decades, everyday people have become more environmentally conscious, desiring clean air and clean infrastructure. That led Chinese Communist Party leaders to invest in green energy.
The government spent a lot of money. And also, I think the government realized that this is not just an issue of China. It also provides opportunity.
Opportunity to become a world leader. As Zhang explains it, developing green technology isn't just a means of cutting emissions and improving quality of life at home. It also helps the country surpass economic competitors on the global stage. Take the auto industry, for example. 10 years ago, you probably wouldn't be able to name a Chinese car maker. But today, led by Shenzhen-based EV maker BYD, the country dominates production and exports of electric vehicles. Zhang tells me there's a Chinese phrase that captures the moment.
It's called the Wandao Chaoche.
That roughly translates to pass at the curve or leapfrog competitors in a race.
If you just look at the mechanical cars, the conventional cars, there's no chance for the Chinese manufacturers to surpass the European and even the Japanese manufacturers. Right? But then they take this EV as an opportunity to be able to take an upper hand.
An upper hand they now have. In addition to supplying 70% of the world's electric cars and batteries, China manufactures more than 80% of solar panels and 60% of wind turbines. Simply put, China controls the clean energy supply chain.
Beyond the economic gain, there is a geopolitical gain.
That's Bonnie Lin, who directs the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
We know that Xi Jinping has large ambitions for China. He wants China to be a global leader, if not the global leader. So China wants to step up, and China wants to be able to say that it is helping to contribute to reducing the negative effects of climate change and helping countries develop their economies in more sustainable ways. and in ways that the United States is not doing that.
Still, Lin notes that even as China is exporting clean energy around the globe, it remains the world's largest carbon emitter because the implementation of green technology has been uneven across the country. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel, Shenzhen, China.
A monumental verdict today from a special tribunal in Bangladesh.
We have decided to inflict her with only one sentence, that is sentence of death.
A death sentence for the country's ousted Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, found guilty of crimes against humanity. Sheikh Hasina is in exile in India. She denounced the decision from there, calling it biased and politically motivated.
It's a historic moment for Bangladesh and a dramatic one. Zafar Subban is in Bangladesh's capital, Dhaka, where he's editor of the news site Counterpoint. When we spoke today, he explained the basis for the ruling.
Last year, from July and August, there were protests, and they were met with brutal force by the authorities, by the police. By some estimates, over 1,000 people were killed. And so there's a lot of evidence suggesting that, you know, the responsibility for those killings goes all the way to the top, to Sheikh Hasina, who is the prime minister. That's where the buck stops. I should mention that the home minister at the time was also sentenced similarly to capital punishment by this court.
Right. Sheikh Hasina has been handed that death sentence, as I said. What's been the reaction to that news so far today in Dhaka?
In Dhaka, the reaction has been largely, I would say, positive. Emotions are still very raw in Bangladesh. It's barely a year after the uprising in July, which saw the ouster of Sheikh Hasina and her authoritarian government. And of course, before then, we had had, you know, by some accounts, over 1,000 people killed. So those wounds are still very fresh. I think for many people, this is a measure of justice, which they have been waiting for a year. And they feel that this kind of accountability is something we've never really seen in the history of Bangladesh. And it really helps us turn the corner because, you know, we are in a transition phase in Bangladesh. We've been ruled by an interim government for the past year and a bit. And general elections are scheduled for February. But I think many people feel that before we move on to general elections, they would like to see some measure of accountability. We're talking about a record of extrajudicial executions, people being disappeared. We're talking about a network of secret prisons. There's a long history of atrocity here, which people feel we're finally now getting some measure of accountability for.
Sheikh Hasina's reaction from exile in India, she said that the ruling is biased and politically motivated. What do you make of that?
If you were to look at the legal proceedings, due process was in many ways lacking. And so that is certainly a legitimate concern. She's almost certainly guilty of the crimes that she is charged for. I mean, I think there is an abundance of evidence suggesting that she is entirely culpable if you look at a legal theory of sort of command responsibility. But by the same token, she did not have an opportunity to defend herself in court, and a lot of the things which we expect in terms of due process were missing. I will point out that, you know, she was tried in absentia. She is right now in exile in India, and right, the chances of her being returned to face punishment are more or less non-existent.
So, Zafar, you were critical of the due process that was missing in Sheikh Hasina's trial. I'm just wondering what you think that all means for the effort to repair and strengthen democracy in Bangladesh.
The judicial system in Bangladesh is fairly dysfunctional. It's been broken for a long time. Some people would argue that it's been broken since its inception. But by the same token, you have people who need to be prosecuted. You have people who need to be brought to justice. So this is this conundrum we have, which we haven't really ever figured out how to solve. Maybe this was the best we could have hoped for. I mean, of course, she has been given capital punishment. She's been sentenced to death. But it doesn't mean she's going to come back and face that capital punishment. In that sense, you could say that the verdict is almost a symbolic verdict.
Well, I wanted to ask you, I mean, Sheikh Hasina is currently in exile in India. Is it possible Indian authorities will extradite her to Bangladesh?
Oh, I mean, I think there's no question that they will not extradite her. She's long been a ally of Delhi. They've been strong supporter of her. So I think, you know, they're also in a precarious diplomatic position vis-a-vis Bangladesh. They do want to keep good relations with the interim government. They want to keep good relations with the incoming government after February's election. But I think this would be a step too far.
Bangladesh gained independence from Pakistan under the leadership of Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, Sheikh Hasina's father and the country's first leader, which is a pretty amazing family legacy. Can it protect Sheikh Hasina in any way?
Of course, for many, many years, Sheikh Hasina's political pedigree was a big part of her story. And of course, the fact that, you know, that she was the daughter of Bangladesh's founding president and the hero of our independence war, that was, of course, a big part of her narrative, a big part of who she was. I think, though, where Bangladesh is in 2025, I think because of her misdeeds over the last 15 years and where the public has moved, I don't think that that any longer is something which will give her that protection. In fact, I think many people feel that she has in many ways misused and abused the memory of her father, who is still, you know, widely revered. And so people are trying to separate her from the legacy of her father, saying, well, you know, he was one person, but she is another. And then you can't really necessarily conflate the two.
Will that be her longer legacy, though, like the dark daughter of Bangladesh's founding father?
One of the things which is very apparent to me is if you look at young people, you know, the younger generation, there's still an enormous amount of anger, an enormous amount of pain, because they, of course, were at the front lines of this movement and, of course, who bore the brunt of the attacks. In that generation, I think there's a great deal of antipathy towards Sheikh Hasina and her political party, which is not likely to dissipate anytime soon. Whether that will continue to be her legacy decades from now remains to be seen. I think that's always a tough one to call.
Zafar Subhan, the editor of Bangladeshi news site Counterpoint, speaking with us from the capital Dhaka about the death sentence handed down today for former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina.
Women of the European Union, today we send you our commiseration this Equal Pay Day. Marco, are you familiar with Equal Pay Day?
Yeah, it's a symbolic thing, right, to show actually how unequal pay is between men and women.
Right. Equal Pay Day is about the gender pay gap. So let's say women make 70 cents on the dollar that men make. In that case, one way to even the score would be for women to work only 70% of the hours that men work so that they end up making the same amount per hour as men. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I totally follow. It's not fair, but I follow. And so with today being Equal Pay Day in Europe, that means what?
Well, according to the European Commission, today is the symbolic day when women there should stop working for the rest of the year so that their annual salary adds up to the same per hour rate as men. They say that women essentially work for free for the rest of the year.
I actually did read up on this, Carolyn, and the Commission says women earn about 12% less than men across the EU. And of course, the wage gap is not exclusive to Europe.
Of course not, Marco. In the U.S., the pay gap is bigger. Women make 15% less than men. Zoom in on what that looks like for Black, Latina, and Indigenous women, and the pay gap grows even wider. But what we noticed here in the newsroom today is that the U.S. marks Equal Pay Day a little differently than Europe.
Yeah, say more about that, Carolyn.
Well, in Europe, they illustrate this by imagining that women should stop working early to balance out the symbolic ledger. Whereas in the U.S., we mark Equal Pay Day in the spring because we think about how long a woman would have to work past the end of the calendar year to earn as much as a man did in that year. So basically, it's when women just work a bunch extra to catch up with men.
I mean, it's a classic difference in how Europeans and Americans view work in general, right? Europe's like, stop working if you're not getting paid.
Yeah, and the U.S. is like, no, just work harder.
More depressing stories still to come.
Though I might take off the rest of the show. Flesh-eating parasites, anyone? That is just ahead. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. and Mexico are teaming up to stop the spread of a flesh-eating parasite. It's called the New World Screwworm. It's been infecting livestock throughout Central America and working its way north. Now it's reached southern Mexico, where it's spreading, but authorities have a plan to stop it. Philip Kaufman explained it to us. He joined the show from Texas A&M, where he heads the Department of Entomology.
Most people have seen blowflies if they've ever seen a dead animal, say, on the side of the road, and it's covered in metallic flies, and their immatures or larvae are the maggots you see on a dead animal. This fly is the same classification as those flies, except it's different in that it no longer is interested in dead animals. It will only lay its eggs on open wounds of live animals. And then those maggots essentially eat the tissue of the live animal and can often result in the death of that animal. So it's a very important pest, and it's one that is not new to North America. It had been here in the past, and we had eradicated it some 50 years ago, and now it's making an incursion back north, which has us all very concerned.
So is this thing a parasite or is it an insect?
It is both. So it's an insect that uses a parasitic lifestyle. So it only exists when there are other living animals around that it is a parasite of. So it feeds on the tissues of living animals, and then the maggot crawls out of that host, falls to the ground, transforms into an adult fly through the pupal stage on the ground, and then the adult fly, when she's ready to lay eggs, will lay eggs back in an open wound of a living animal.
I got to say, the phrase flesh-eating parasite is scary and worrying. How significant of a threat does the New World screwworm pose?
So this is a pest that has been estimated that if it were to arrive in Texas, between our livestock and our wildlife industries, could cause as much as $10 billion in damage. It's considered a foreign animal disease pest, which carries trade implications. And so there are foreign countries that could essentially not accept U.S. beef because if we have this pest shows up here and it becomes established, it could have trade implications. It also is disruptive to our own process of how we produce meat for this country.
And Philip, what is the actual risk to people? Like, how severe is the New World screwworm to human health?
So, you know, it affects any mammal, and humans are mammals. And so there are cases, it's not terribly frequent, but it can in fact get on humans. The greatest risk are to individuals who are homeless or who don't have the capacity to care for themselves, because this is a very painful insect. And if it were to get into a human would very much know that they have something wrong. When you have populations that are at risk, this can go undiagnosed. And it's not that the fly itself necessarily kills a person. It's the bacterial septicemia that comes along with having that insect in you that is likely to cause the problem.
Is it accurate to say, though, that the biggest worry is to livestock?
You know, we expect it would have a severe impact on our livestock operations, but it's going to have a severe impact on our wildlife populations as well. And South Texas has a great population size that we did not have 50 years ago when we last eradicated this pest.
The U.S. is actually working on a facility in Mexico to prevent this from spreading north. What is that effort all about?
So we currently have one plant that produces sterile insects, and that plant is located down in Panama, where the fly had been contained. The USDA provided Mexico with some funding to renovate a fruit fly production plant in southern Mexico to start producing New World screwworm, because we don't have enough sterile flies to re-eradicate the pest. And that plant is scheduled to open, I believe, next summer. It's predicted to almost double the production of the sterile flies that are released to combat this.
Can you just explain why sterile flies work? What's that going to do?
So the New World screwworm, the female of that species will mate only one time. And if she mates with a male that's been sterilized, she'll not mate again. And all of the eggs that she lays will be infertile and will not hatch. And so the program is that they raise these flies, they expose those flies to a radiation source that essentially breaks up their chromosomes so it doesn't produce eggs or sperm. And so when that male mates with the female, she'll continue to lay eggs, but none of those eggs will ever hatch. And then eventually that population dies out and you no longer have the screwworm in the area. That's what we used the last time, and that's what we're going to use again. The only problem is right now we can't produce enough flies to cover the vast acreage that is Texas and northern Mexico.
How closely are these U.S. agencies and organizations working with countries in Central America right now, like Panama, and also with Mexico?
You know, the U.S. is running the dispersal program where they're releasing the flies. They're training Mexican authorities on how to inspect their animals before they ship them. In Panama, the U.S. and Panama have a joint program where they raise these flies, and it's 24/7 operations at this plant in Panama. Right now, we're in kind of a hold-the-line mode, and it's going to take a couple of years before we have enough flies ready to start pushing that line back south.
Philip Kaufman is a professor of entomology at Texas A&M, explaining a flesh-eating parasite and insect called the New World Screwworm and the cross-border efforts to stop it from reproducing.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
Yesterday in Chile was the first round in their presidential election. The two leading candidates are leftist Jeanette Jara and on the far right, José Antonio Kast. They will now compete in a runoff election. Kast is projected to have the upper hand. 70% of the votes in yesterday's election went to conservative candidates.
Election results are also in from Ecuador. Voters there struck down a referendum to amend the constitution. The proposed amendments would have allowed foreign powers to operate military bases in the country and also expanded the government's authority to punish criminals and control the borders. The failed vote is a political defeat for the country's conservative president, Daniel Noboa. He campaigned on cracking down on crime.
And staying in Ecuador, one of the country's most wanted drug kingpins, Wilmer Chavarria, faked his own death and fled the country in 2021. But yesterday in Spain, he was arrested, so still alive. Chavarria is the suspected leader of a drug trafficking gang called Los Lobos. He's believed to have been running the gang from overseas for the past 4 years.
And those are a few things you might have missed. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Trump administration policies have made the U.S. less attractive for international students, and we're now getting data about the impact that's had on actual enrollment at U.S. colleges. A new report from the Institute of International Education shows that the number of first-year international students is down 17% compared to last year. Higher ed reporter Kirk Carapeza at GBH in Boston tells us today's report confirms expectations.
More than 800 colleges and universities have participated in what the Institute calls its fall snapshot. This is an early look at this year's numbers, and that 70% drop in enrollment is not looking good for colleges. I should say, just to contextualize this, even with the steep drop expected this fall, the U.S. remains the top destination for international students.
But that still is a significant number. 17% sounds pretty high.
Yes. In the previous academic year, international students contributed nearly $55 billion to the U.S. economy. So you can imagine if you lose about 20% of those students, that's a huge economic hit.
So, Kirk, what are you hearing from people working in higher ed about what is driving this drop?
So, Professor Geraldo Blanco directs Boston College's Center for International Higher Education.
I think there is a sense that international students are not unambiguously welcome in the United States, and I think that is a significant change in the mood for higher education.
Not unambiguously welcome.
Yeah, and Blanco says the fallout will hit hardest at schools that rely on international students to offset declining domestic enrollment. At Brandeis University, just outside of Boston, international students made up 17% of last year's first-year class. This fall, Carolyn, that's down to 12%. I asked Brandeis President Arthur Levine what impact he's seeing from the administration's visa policies and restrictions.
Given the threats that higher education faces in this country, if I lived abroad, I'm not sure I'd send my child to a school in the United States.
And while that affects schools' bottom line, since many of these students pay full tuition, Levine says the bigger loss is to the country.
What we're losing is an opportunity to educate people about this country. And what we're losing is an opportunity to make people friendlier toward the United States than we ever have before. We're also causing ourselves to have a brain drain. Some of these people stay in the United States, and they're some of the best.
So how is the administration or those who support their moves here responding to these early trend lines?
They say these schools are crying wolf. Simon Hankinson is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Center for Border Security and Immigration. He says colleges like Brandeis are scaremongering and pushing what he sees as a self-serving narrative.
The schools that have tried to replace American students with foreign students, either because they don't have the numbers or in many cases because they just want the higher fees, they're going to use all of their political and other clout to try to change that because that's their business model.
Hankinson attributes the decline this fall not to Trump administration policies, but to demographics in sending countries, especially China, where that country's one-child policy has led to an aging population and fewer college-age students each year.
And China sends some of the most international
students to the U.S. Most now after India.
Second most. So what other trends are you seeing in the data around this?
So more selective schools, places like Harvard, MIT, Stanford, they aren't seeing major declines in their international undergraduates. If any students face visa issues this summer or had second thoughts about studying here because of our political climate, these schools simply tapped into their wait lists.
Sure.
Some graduate-level programs, like those at Georgetown in D.C., are seeing steep drops. They cite visa and immigration challenges. But again, the most selective programs appear largely insulated from this so far.
I know the international student enrollment also dropped in Trump's first term.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, it dropped 12 percentage points during the first Trump administration. You'll remember there was the travel ban, right? There were visa restrictions back then, too. And then there was that controversial pandemic era rule that required all international students to take classes in person.
Did it bounce back after that? And does that hold any lessons for what might be to come now?
It did under the Biden administration. But, you know, we're not even 1 year into the Trump administration. And the experts I'm talking to say no one in Washington is coming to save these schools. You know, these institutions are under a lot of new pressures domestically to make their programs more affordable and accessible to American students.
Mm. GVH's Kirk Carapeza, thank you so much for this update.
Thank you.
International students coming to the U.S. have an impact not just here, but also in the students' home countries. Nelly Chaboy grew up in a village in Kenya, and after coming to the U.S. for her studies, she brought what she learned back home with her. Reporter Brianna Duggan reports from Mogotio, Kenya.
Before she started university in Illinois, Nelly Chaboy had been prepared for some changes from her life in Kenya.
What life is in America is like.
She'd been warned about the winter, so she arrived in a floor-length down coat in August. Then there were the men.
Even things like American men will hold the door for you. I mean, Kenyan men don't do that.
University in America was heaven for a serious student like Chaboy. Compared to Kenya, she says the teachers made learning easy.
I ended up doing three majors, chemistry, math, and computer science. That's just like how I found it so easy. And then I just love school. And then the professor, like, Ed, open hours. You could ask them questions. They were not, like, strict and mean. It was fantastic.
But the thing that really struck Chaboy in the U.S. was abundance. Not so much the things, although those would come in handy later. It was the mindset that came with abundance.
So everything seemed in reach. And I did not know that because, you know, when you grow up in poverty, you're all just trying. There's just so much like pain and resentment when you're just trying to survive.
Nelly grew up in Mogotio, a small town 4 hours north of Nairobi. Today, on a single-lane paved road, a few motorbikes shuttle through town. Dusty roads spread out through the interior. When Chaboy was growing up, it was a life of scarcity. All her single mom could afford was a tin-roofed building up one of those dusty tracks.
I saw poverty like up close, like seeing it through the lens of my mom. She'd wake up at 5 a.m. and go to the roadside and try to sell things, get home at 10 p.m. sometimes, and we didn't even have food to eat. It was really raw, and so education for me seemed like the only opportunity I had because I just knew that I needed to take care of her. I needed to get us out of poverty.
Nelly studied hard, graduating as one of the country's top students. She was accepted to a year-long prep course for U.S. colleges. But despite applying to 24 schools, she was rejected by all of them. So she went back to her village to help her mom sell at the roadside stand.
I was the one waking up at 5 a.m. now and baking chapatis and sitting there trying to sell it. And it wasn't, the business was really rough at the time, so it wasn't doing well at all. So I'll just sit there for hours and there's no one there. And I remember I just kept like writing resumes on a piece of paper, writing my resume and imagining. It just felt so unfair.
Then, weeks before the fall semester, a last-minute offer came through. A full ride to Augustana College in Western Illinois. Once there, even though academics were easy, Chiboy totally lacked digital skills. Typing, even Googling. She had used a computer for the first time when she was 18. Typing a line of code could take her half an hour.
I just kept saying, Nelly, you made it all the way from rural Kenya to America. The reason you're struggling with this is simply because you grew up in Mogotio. And that was supposed to give me solace. But what we did was, what about kids growing up in Mogotio?
Today, 9 years after graduating, Nelly has become an education leader in Kenya. She built a school in her hometown where kids run around in yellow sweaters and blue pants, the colors of Augustana College. The yellow curtains and blue walls in the classroom, even the dress she's wearing today, all an ode to her alma mater. Chiboy is a shameless self-promoter, reaching out to celebrities she doesn't know, like YouTuber Mr. Beast, for support.
Hi, Mr. Beast. My name is Nelly Chiboy, and this is my school. Crazy, right? We are asking you for a swimming pool, and it's just going to go right there.
But it has paid off.
All you have to do is be a marketer, which I'm good at. So you just have to tell your story and be. So, for example, right now, we have had people come visit the school. So we've had astronauts come visit the school, chess masters. We've had Logitech, you know, donate keyboards. To even a kid like Sharon, who just types really fast.
Alongside math and reading, students learn coding, 3D design, web development. 14-year-old Maurice Bowen is working on his website.
How can I work on size so that when screen becomes smaller?
That's called responsive design. So I can show you. But for now, you can do...
Chiboy's mission is to bring digital technology education to rural communities, believing that a connection to the gig economy can help lift them out of poverty. TechLit, the organization she co-founded with her American husband, brings curriculum, teachers, and computers to 10,000 rural students in Kenya and Uganda. She takes me to a room at the end of a long open-air hallway. Shelves are stacked with desktop computers, laptops, and monitors.
I think we're looking at ballpark around 2,000, 3,000 computers.
In the U.S., Chiboy was shocked to learn that many companies throw out their computers every 4 years because they become too slow. She lifts up a laptop from a pile of computers.
This one is about like 4 years old. So we may actually get another 10 years of here because any broken part we find, we fix it. So we haven't really thrown anything away so far.
For the next generation, she wants kids not to just get an education and learn technology, but to have fun while doing it. And, if it's available for them, a route to study in America.
I often think about what would have happened if I'd stayed in Kenya, if I didn't leave. I mean, I would have done maybe something remarkable, but I don't think it would have been at this scale.
A lesson she hopes they go home with? That no matter one's circumstances, to turn away from a perception of scarcity to one of abundance. For The World, I'm Brianna Duggan, Mogotio, Kenya.
The story first aired in September as part of our special program on global higher education with support from the Lumina Foundation. You can learn more at theworld.org.
Staying with the theme of education, we turn to Germany's famed apprenticeship programs. Free vocational training, and it comes with on-the-job experience and a paycheck. But fewer and fewer Germans want those apprenticeships. Valerie Hamilton brings us the story from Munich.
In Germany, learning to be a restaurant cook is a 3-year apprenticeship. Andrea Ortuño just started.
Ich bin Andrea Ortuño. Ich bin 19 Jahre alt. Ich komme aus Ecuador. Und ich bin
She's 19, and after studying German at school in Ecuador, she joined the Pschorr restaurant in Munich as an apprentice. The first thing she learned to make was Spätzle, a kind of squiggly egg noodle that's a German staple. In this traditional style pub with its long communal tables and wooden barrels of beer, she's training alongside 23 other apprentices from Germany as well as from Ukraine, Azerbaijan, Vietnam, and the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. In Germany this year, one in six apprentices is a foreigner, most from outside the EU.
Man kann auch das in der Berufsschule sehen, also fast alle sind Ausländer und ja, es ist
Ortuño says at the trade school where she studies alongside her restaurant training, almost all of the students are foreigners. In Ecuador, she says, it's hard to find a job and expensive to train as a cook, so this is a great opportunity to learn a profession and earn a salary at the same time. That earn-as-you-learn model is a traditional cornerstone of Germany's economy and educational system. Nearly half of Germans started their careers as apprentices, known colloquially as Azubis. They became the electricians, nurses, bankers, florists, and yes, restaurant cooks that for decades drove Germany's economic success. But Germany's population is aging, and so the pipeline of young Azubis is shrinking. More young Germans are opting for college instead of apprenticeships, studying STEM instead of Spätzle. This year, one in three apprenticeships went unfilled, a shortage of 130,000 future skilled workers. 9 years ago, the German Chamber of Commerce and Industry started a project to match young refugees living in Germany with apprenticeships. It's been successful, but it's not enough. There's still more demand for apprentices than supply. The project recently expanded to help businesses recruit migrants from overseas. German-American Jennifer Crutchfield is a project coordinator.
You can make it a political thing, but it is basically also a very important business decision for companies. Because they're short of workers.
Now the German government has changed visa rules to make it easier to hire from abroad, raising age ceilings and lowering language requirements. It's partnering with foreign governments, language schools, and even influencers to spread the word. This is Ghanaian content creator Kofi Dutchi.
The program, called Azubi, German word for apprentice, connects skilled Ghanaian youth with German companies for vocational training and long-term job opportunities.
The Federal Labor Agency's recruitment website, Make It in Germany, hosts peppy testimonial videos with success stories of immigrant apprentices.
Hallo, ich bin der Kingsley. Ich bin 23 Jahre alt. Ich komme aus Nigeria.
Like Kingsley from Nigeria, who apprenticed and then got a job with a trucking company. Between refugees and migrants, there are now close to 180,000 foreign apprentices training in Germany, an increase of 30% since 2022. Alexander Kritikos is an economist at the German Institute for Economic Research. He says recruiting foreign apprentices is about building skills for Germany, not taking advantage of cheap labor.
In Germany, we are not hiring cheap labor from poor countries. We are rather in need of hiring people with well education from poor countries.
Three quarters of Azubis get hired for real jobs in their fields after their apprenticeships. But being an apprentice has a price. You have to learn German before you can start. Once you do, an apprenticeship is still seen as an education, not a job. And for those 3 years, the pay is really low, on average about $1,200 a month. That makes it hard to find housing and impossible to save or send money home. Alongside the hiring boom, there has also been a boom in fraud and exploitation. Like in Vietnam, where, according to German media reports, a shady cottage industry milks prospective apprentices for as much as $23,000 for visas and language certificates. That can land them in debt or worse. Jürgen Lochbieler runs the Pschorr restaurant in Munich. He's apprentice cook Andrea Ortuño's boss. When he opened 20 years ago, he says all of his apprentices were German. But now?
Die Zukunft ist international und wir sind in unserer
The future is international. And international is good.
Bei den Ausländischen ist es so, dass sie viel mehr bewusst die Entscheidung
He says foreign Azubis are more invested in their apprenticeships and more likely to have the grit it takes to see them through. Ortuño says her first weeks were really tough. Her whole body hurt from standing all day, and even though she knew German, there was a lot she didn't understand.
Und man muss also richtig viel Bock darüber haben und richtig einfach.
She says to make it in Germany, you have to really want it, because an apprenticeship is already hard work, and for foreigners, it's even harder. For the World, I'm Valerie Hamilton, Munich.
Getting from point A to point B takes up a certain amount of time in most people's day. That amount of time, though, is surprisingly consistent, regardless of where in the world you live, what mode of transportation you use, or how much money is in your bank account. The average daily travel time globally, 78 minutes. That's according to new research from the Institute of Environmental Science and Technology at the Autonomous University of Barcelona. Eric Galbraith led that research.
So this actually grew out of an earlier study called the Global Human Day, where we were trying to characterize all of the time that all humans in the world spend in the full range of activities.
And when you say activities, what are we talking about? Like going to work, shopping, taking kids to school, that kind of thing?
That's right, everything. And there was a lot of interesting things in there. But one of the things that really jumped out at us was the fact that across the countries in our sample, regardless of how wealthy a country was, the average amount of time traveled by people within the country didn't really vary.
78 minutes on average is a metric you came up with. Explain the basics of how you determine that.
Sure. So this is really just from compiling all of these surveys that have been carried out in different countries around the world, including time use surveys, but also economic surveys, and that just hadn't been put together on one page before. We also included alongside the personal travel, the travel that was done for work. So whether people are driving taxis or buses, we put them all together in this one overall picture of human travel time.
I mean, the fact that we spend this time in transit and it doesn't really matter where you are in the world, financial means or mode of transport, it is surprising. Why is it so consistent, though?
So I should say we were not the first people to notice this. It was a surprise to us when it came out of the data because we hadn't heard about this before. But it turns out that in the urban planning literature, this had been pointed out as early as the 1970s. Originally, this was noticed in the United States, but then they expanded these surveys and they found that it was pretty much true with cities wherever they looked. People seemed to travel for about the same amount of time. And so people proposed that there was a travel budget, a certain amount of time that people were willing to spend traveling, and that was fixed. But then, of course, scientists being scientists, they argued with each other. They said, oh, that's not quite right because, look, people have been traveling less in the Netherlands this year than they did the year before. It's not actually constant. And so somehow the idea got lost. But so really when we've come back to this, we've seen, wow, this is actually even more extensive than they thought. And it really does seem to be some kind of universal tendency. And that doesn't mean that everybody is traveling for the same amount every day. Of course, that's not true. So yeah. It's not that it's universal and constant, but it's very consistently pulled towards the central value of about 1.3 hours per day altogether. And it's got to show some kind of basic psychological features, something like we like to travel for a certain amount, but not too much.
Is there kind of an intolerance to going above 78 minutes?
There's definitely got to be some kind of intolerance. Absolutely. I mean, you know it. I know it. You get frustrated when you're spending hours in traffic. No, it's unpleasant. You feel like you're wasting your time. We do find that, you know, in some countries, people do travel more on average. South Korea stands out as, you know, at the top end of the scale, where people are traveling more than an hour and a half per day on average. So again, it's not that it's a fixed constant, but don't fall that far from the central value, no matter what else is going on. And this happens despite cities having very different urban designs. You know, there are some of these places people are traveling by high-speed train. Some of them they're driving everywhere. Some of them they're mostly walking and traveling by bicycle. Some of the cities are very compact. Others are sprawling over huge distances. But despite all of these things, people are traveling for about the same amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, I know a guy who voluntarily commuted 2 hours each way from South Jersey to New York City. I also spent time in Lagos, Nigeria, where no one wants to be stuck in traffic for 4 hours, 5 hours a day, but they do. Do you know if these numbers have gone up or down in recent years? Because I think of the pandemic when travel times for commuting anyway dropped drastically as people work from home. And we also know it's been hard to get people back in offices. How did that and how does it continue to impact the numbers?
Yeah, so the pandemic was really a huge shock to travel times. And that was something that we looked into. We found that there were actually compensations in the travel time. So even though people were traveling less for commuting, they undertook more voluntary travel. You know, if I think back to the pandemic, I remember that feeling of going stir crazy. I just had to get out of the house and go for a walk, you know, do something. And that really shows up that people compensated for the lack of commuting.
So what insights can we derive from the statistic as we think about the future of transportation while also trying to wean ourselves off of the reliance on fossil fuels?
So this has really important implications for the use of energy in travel. We often think that by increasing fuel efficiency, such as raising the miles per gallon of a vehicle, we can improve the energy, you know, consumption, get that number down. But in fact, what really matters is the energy consumption per hour of travel, because on average, societies are just traveling for about the same amount of time, no matter what kind of technology they're using. So the important thing is how much energy is that technology using per person per hour. And that is the number that at the end of the day is going to determine the overall energy consumption, regardless of what else happens. Doesn't matter how the city changes in other ways, what kind of technology comes. That is a number that I think you can really count on, that number is not going to move very much. So it's the energy consumption per hour that matters.
Eric, what's your daily travel time?
But it's in flux right now.
I'm still calculating it.
It tends to be a bit less. I go for about an hour.
Yeah, mine is pretty crazy. It's either 25 minutes or 25 seconds, depending on where I'm working from. Anyway, Eric Galbraith is a researcher at the Institute of Environmental Science and Technology at the Autonomous University of Barcelona. Thank you very much.
Real pleasure.
Thanks for starting off the week with us. Tomorrow, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia will be at the White House meeting with President Trump. It caps a rehabilitation of Mohammed bin Salman's public image over the past 7 years since he allegedly orchestrated the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Be with us for that report in tomorrow's show.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org, as well as our original reporting on YouTube. You can also subscribe there to our channel. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.
PRX. From PRX.